When something goes well, look out the window. So don't look at yourself. But when something goes wrong, look in the mirror. And I think that's really stuck with me, that, you know, there are times where things don't go well in the business and it's easy for me to blame others. But, you know, often I just try and look at myself and what role did I play and what did I learn from it. Hello and welcome to the podcast, 10 Lessons Learned, where we discern wisdom for career, business and life to an international audience of rising leaders. In other words, you'll find valuable insights that you can't find in a textbook because it took us years to learn this stuff. My name is Jeffrey Wang, the founder of Professional Development Forum and your host today. This podcast is sponsored by the Professional Development Forum, which helps diverse young professionals of any age find fulfillment in the modern workplace. Today, we're joined by Brad Chan. Brad is a CEO, an angel investor, a mentor to startups, a philanthropist, and one of the most well-respected Asian Australian community leaders today. Brad is the CEO of Banner Property Group, one of Australia's most established family companies run by third generation, which operates across retail, entertainment, and commercial property. Haymarket HQ, which we're here today, is a thriving startup incubator focused on growth into Asian markets. This was created due to his vision of an innovation hub in the center of Sydney's Chinatown. Brad sat on the board of the Museum of Chinese in Australia and currently sits on the board of Northcross Limited, amongst many others. Brad established the Banner Foundation in 2016, which is the philanthropic arm of his family business, supporting a range of charities, including a UTS humanitarian scholarship for the past 4 years. Brad is also formerly the president of the Haymarket Chamber of Commerce. He's an advisor to the City of Sydney Chinese New Year Festival and is currently on the City of Sydney's Business Advisory Panel. Last year, Brad launched the Neon Playground, which is a festival of lights, art, music, in order to bring people back into Sydney's Chinatown after the pandemic. Thank you so much for joining us today, Brad.
Thanks for having me, Jeff. I really like that introduction. I think I'll have to borrow it sometime.
Well, this just goes on to show just how humble you are, Brad, because you deserve every bit of it. One thing I failed to mention in my introduction is that you're also one of my favorite leaders in the Asian Australian community.
Oh, that's a real big honor there, Jeff. Thank you.
Well, I've been after you to come onto this podcast for, gosh, probably over 2 years now. It's because I know that you have a lot of wisdom to share. You know, there's a reason why a quiet leader like yourself is so widely followed and admired by the community. And I feel like, you know, there's a lot of wisdom there that we can unpack.
I'll do my best, Jeff. It's pretty high expectations there, but yeah, we'll see how we go.
All right. Well, let's just jump straight into it then. Lesson number one, live your values. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, and I should probably just preface these 10 lessons by saying I've actually linked each of these lessons to a particular book that I've read. And the reason I've done that is for a couple of reasons. Firstly, I'd love to be able to say that all of my lessons, all of my ideas are original, but unfortunately, everything I've learned has come from somewhere. And so the second part of this is around just making sure that your listeners have enough substance if they want to delve a little bit more into one of the lessons. There's a lot of great material out there that they can turn to. So probably providing a summary of my lessons. And so if you want a bit more information, I'll also provide the context to, I guess, a book that I've found quite useful to me in my life. So with the first one, Live Your Values. So this actually comes from a book called How Will You Measure Your Life by Clay Christensen. And he wrote this in about 2012. He passed away a couple of years ago. And I think if I had to give one of my kids a book, this would probably be it. I think this is a really important book. And what Clay wrote about was, I guess, the importance of how you lived your life and how you spent your time. And he was an economics lecturer at, I think, Harvard University. And he applied business theories and applied them to how to live your life. And one of those theories was, for example, around resource allocation. It's a common business term, but the way he applied it to living life was, you know, we all have a limited resource in our life, and the most important of those is time. And so we need to be really careful about how we invest our time. And he really spoke about not over-investing in work and under-investing in life, but rather the opposite. And I think for a lot of us, we get caught into the trap of what we think society tells us we should do and spend a lot of our limited time in areas that in hindsight don't mean or matter so much to us. I think the other thing he really emphasized was living your values. And Jeff, we just had lunch before this and we spoke about one of the lessons you've learned, and sort of turning it back to you, was realizing that you spend a lot of time in a particular company, it, I guess, conflicted with your views or didn't match your values.
Yeah, it didn't align with my values. Yeah.
And you wish you realized that sooner. Hmm. And so this author here, Clay, he talks about understanding what your values are and upholding them. And he even says that it's easier to uphold your values or your principles 100% of the time than it is to do it 98% of the time, because, you know, sometimes we give in at a particular occasion and then it's easier to keep giving in and giving in. And so, and he gave the example himself when he was young. He was a Christian and he believed that he needed to keep Sunday as, I guess, a day that he really rested. So he even later in life gave up the final of a basketball tournament, decided to sit out. And that was a really difficult decision for him. And I think he looks back at that time as a decision to uphold his values, and he's never had to compromise on it again in the future. And so a really good lesson for us all. I spend a bit of time sort of coaching people, and one of the exercises I do is we talk about values, trying to identify what your top three values are. Because, you know, I think it's not a question we get asked very often.
And, no.
And if you do get asked that question, you know, how well can you answer it?
Well, that's a really good point, Brad, because I think I know which exercise you're talking about, and I did it a while back, you know, a couple of years back, and I remember it being a very excruciating exercise of identifying my values, right? And just relating back to our conversation over lunch, one of the things that I came to realize later on was that I was not clear about what my own values were. It was only with the benefit of hindsight in life that I realized and I reflected and I became aware and I had clarity over what those values were. So is there a strategy that you can give? Is there an advice you can give to young people who are yet to discover what their innermost values are on discovering what they are?
Yeah, I actually do an exercise, and I've done this, you know, dozens and dozens of times, but I have a pack of cards and they're values cards. And, you know, typically I'll ask someone at the start, well, what are your top three values? You know, what are those things that you would hold dear to yourself that you would not compromise on, even if it was to your disadvantage? And, you know, some people could sort of answer it, they'd think about it, I might get some I'm not sure's, and then we do the exercise with the cards and I get them to through a process of elimination, go through each of the values, put them in three poles, not important to me and very important to me. And we focus on the cards in the very important to me category. And through a process of further elimination, we get down to top five. And then it's actually hard to get down from five to three. And those three typically allow you to look at all a whole bunch of different values and then narrow it down to what you feel is really important to you. And then I ask the question, how satisfied are you that you are living each of these values? Out of 10, how satisfied are you? And that really opens up a discussion around, well, if it's a 6 or a 7, you know, why isn't that score higher? Where am I spending my time? What am I putting in my life instead of living this value so that I'm satisfied? So it really helps identify maybe some changes that someone needs in their life as well.
Indeed. And hence why it was so excruciatingly hard, because it's when you put these values up side by side that you realize you have to rank them in the order of importance. And for everything that you choose, you have to not choose something else, which I think is probably the hardest part. But I think once you have that clarity, then you've got a hierarchy of your values in which then you can act. And that's what makes it so powerful, isn't it? Mm.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think it's quite liberating once it's clear to you what your values are. And then the next advice I give is, you know, uphold these values and even help them to make decisions in your life. You know, should I accept this job offer? Will it align with my values? Will this company give me, you know, what I need to live my values? And if, for example, family time is one of my key values and it's a job where I'm going to be working extremely long hours, then maybe that helps answer that question about whether you should take that job and whether you'll be happy in the job. Life's often a choice. So, you know, I'm just clear on what my choices are.
Well, I love that clarity that you have in your life. Thank you for that very insightful lesson. Lesson number two, introversion is a superpower. Now, I love this topic because I remember attending one of your talks in the past where literally we had the record crowd turning out, you know, 200 people packed into a capacity 100 room. It was very crowded, but it just goes on to show just how important this concept of introversion as a superpower was, particularly to that crowd.
Yeah, true. And I think it is a very relatable topic. And I think for me growing up, you know, something I did struggle with when I look back was, you know, I was a quiet guy and I always felt that I needed to be different. I needed to be louder. I needed to be more assertive. I needed to be more outgoing. And it really took some time to actually appreciate that introversion is a superpower and I didn't have to be the opposite. And, you know, the book here is called Quiet by Susan Cain, and she really brought out into the public the, I guess, the message that we do live in an extroverted world, or the ideal is an extrovert, whereas we often underestimate the influence and, I guess, the benefits of introverts. And so for me, here is, and I think a lot of people will be able to relate to this, and particularly those of Asian background, because I think there's some cultural aspects to this as well. But you know, you don't have to be anyone that you're not. And in fact, if you are quiet or introverted, then there's a lot of benefits to that. And there are a lot of, you know, a lot of amazing creatives and a lot of amazing leaders that are introverts. And so let's not look at the big, loud leaders as our inspiration, but look elsewhere.
Indeed. So is there an example in your life where introversion has helped you succeed?
Yeah, I mean, I use it now quite effectively, I think, with the coaching that I do. And when I do one-on-one coaching with someone, you know, probably 90% of the time I'm listening, I'm not talking, and I'm able to ask really insightful questions, challenge the other person. Whereas I think if it was the opposite, if I was doing most of the talking, I don't think the session would be as effective. And so I think the ability to listen and to think and to reflect and then to challenge back, I think, yeah, it's something that makes me better at that task than I would if, you know, I had different skills.
So in the world where we're dominated by extroversion, especially at the leadership level, do you find it difficult to sort of assert yourself as the quiet leader?
I wouldn't say I find it difficult. I think the difficulty in the past has been around trying to be real to yourself. You know, often we're trying to be people that we're not. Often we're trying to fit into the culture around us. I think the challenge, therefore, is to be confident enough in yourself to be true and to show who you truly are, rather than to fit in and to be a chameleon, so to speak. And I think the recognition of quiet leaders has grown. You know, I think gone are the days of the old Jack Welch, where it'd be an overly charismatic and dictating leader. Whereas, you know, you get a lot of examples these days of quite considered and more reserved leaders. And don't get me wrong, there are times where you need to be a little bit uncomfortable, where you need to challenge your own introversion to be more effective. But I think by and large, you don't have to be someone that you're not.
And certainly there's a difference between being shy and being introverted. I think the difference being that introversion is about, it costs you energy to interact with others, whereas, you know, being shy is a completely different to kettle of fish. So how did you come to that realization that introversion is not a negative, or that you can, you know, you can succeed despite that introversion?
Yeah. I think just through personal example, I think for one, I mean, in my experience, you know, I've been able to achieve a lot by being who I am. And I have worked in some environments in corporates and the like where I'd say you probably needed to be more extroverted to succeed. And I've made the decision to not stay in those environments, okay, which in hindsight were great decisions. But, you know, I think I've also deliberately chosen to lead my organisation in a particular way. And I'd like to think it hasn't been detrimental to my career. It's, but rather, you know, I've been able to achieve a lot more as a result. And so, yeah, it wasn't a flash of brilliance one day where I suddenly woke up and thought, well, you know, it's introversion's fine. I think it's just been a process of experience, life experiences. And again, you know, revert back to the book and Susan Cain's book, Quiet, just helps reinforce what something that I've probably been gradually thinking and convincing myself over a number of years.
Yeah, and I do remember a really good point you made in the talk you did about introversion, that it's far easier for an introvert to pretend to be an extrovert for a short time than for an extrovert to pretend to be an introvert for a long time, you know, in order to do the work that an introvert does. But I want to extend that idea and challenge you just a little bit more. So in this current climate where we're all about diversity, you know, we have all sorts of quotas out there, gender and cultural and all sorts, you know, should there be a focus on personality styles like the introversion versus extroversion? Should we be having a quota for introverted leadership?
I don't think there's any scientific proof about, you know, what makes an effective organisation in terms of personality styles. They're all beneficial. They've all got their pros and cons. I think what makes effective organisations aren't necessarily about introversion, extroversion, but more around a lot of the soft skills that you also need and how you interact and communicate with people and, you know, how well you think critically and how well you problem solve and all those kinds of things. I think introversion, extroversion, and, you know, I should probably also say that, you know, introversion, extroversion is a spectrum and, you know, they're two extremes and none of us are at either extreme. We're all somewhere along that line. And so, back to your earlier point, you know, I think it is easy for introverts to be able to flex and adapt along that line at times. And I think that's what you also need to be able to recognize. There are times where you need to adapt to a certain situation. There are times where I'm amongst a group of people at dinner, and instead of just talking to the person next to me all night, it will benefit me to also have group discussions and things like that. And, you know, with practice, it becomes easier as well.
Yeah, so thanks for that insight. So it's not so much around whether you're introvert or extrovert, but it's probably more around whether you're able to operate effectively and authentically as yourself. And so don't place that limit on yourself because you're not an extrovert or because you're not a stereotypical leader, and, you know, and that know that your introversion could be your strength and that you should leverage it accordingly.
Yeah, true. And I think it could maybe a different way to think of it is, you know, historically when I growing up, it was probably a self-limiting belief. And, you know, I think you could really flip the switch there and see it as a real advantage if you understand what the advantages of being introverted are.
100%. Lesson number three, challenges are opportunities.
So I base this off quite a well-known book called Mindset by Carol Dweck. And Carol talks about the differences between a growth mindset and a fixed mindset. And, you know, they're probably things we were taught growing up that probably wasn't made so clear to us. You achieve the most growth when you are challenged. And, you know, you can go through life having a fixed mindset and complaining about the things that happen to you, or you can view it differently, see those challenges as opportunities and opportunities to grow from them, to learn from them, to excel from them. I sort of draw this circle and this inner ring and an outer ring. The inner ring is what we call the comfort zone. The outer ring is the learning zone. And, you know, the comfort zone is where we spend most of our time. It's where we feel most comfortable. But the learning zone, this outer ring, is, I guess, where the magic happens. It's where it may be a bit uncomfortable and may challenge us, but it's where we can achieve the most from it. And so it's a good reminder for me and the people I speak to that, you know, we want to be spending time in the learning zone, because if we don't, we're not going to see the great things that can happen to us.
This is a bit of a personal one for me because, you know, many of us grew up with an Asian upbringing, which sometimes implicitly we are taught that sort of you are what you're born into and whatever you're born with is what you've got, and, you know, this is your lot in life, right? So how do you break out of that mindset when you've been conditioned to believe that's all it is, you know? And again, I'll refer to a conversation we had around lunchtime where, you know, we speak about children and their sporting capabilities. You know, sometimes you get told, you know, because of your stature or athletic ability, that's all you ever amount to. And, you know, often aren't aware of the differences you could make by the amount of work you could put into the process.
Yeah, this is a deep question, Jeff. I probably wasn't expecting to get this deep, but, you know, in terms of upbringing, I think maybe what you continue to talk about is self-limiting beliefs. You know, we are told that we can't do certain things. And so how do you break out of those chains that maybe your parents have put on you? And I've sat down with many people in this same situation that are adults, but you know, in a sense, they still see themselves as children under their parents' eyes, and even in their own eyes, and they struggle to have the confidence and the courage to break those chains. Look, it's not an easy answer. I mean, you know, the short answer for me is you're not a child anymore. You know, you're an adult, and you need to live your own life, not the life that your parents think that you should or want you to live. And so there's a lot that goes into how to gain the confidence to achieve this. But I'd say, you know, it certainly helps to address it. It helps to even sit down, you know, look for a mentor or a coach and to help you work through what, you know, what kind of thinking that you have and that you need to be challenged on.
And so do you believe in jumping into the deep end, you know, throw yourself into the most uncomfortable situation you can find, you know, throw yourself in the deep end and see if you float?
Yeah, yes and no, it depends what it is. You know, when I talked about the comfort zone, that ring and the learning zone, I forgot to talk about the very outer ring called the danger zone. Okay, and that's when we are pushed too far. Hmm. And sometimes when we are pushed too far, we fail. Okay. And so I think it's understanding, you know, what is the right amount to be pushed. And because, you know, we don't want to be discouraged at the same time when we're pushed too far. And, you know, we learn very hard lessons. But at the same time, you know, sometimes with hard lessons, there's benefits that come from that as well. So generally take the approach that you build that inner ring. So the comfort zone can grow. And so as you're in that learning zone and you get used to it, it's like, say, driving a car. You first drive a car, gee, it's tough, it's difficult, you're sweating, but with experience and with practice, that becomes something in your comfort zone. Okay. And so, you know, rather than just throwing the deep end, I think there's also steps that you can take to reach that more difficult goal.
So that's
the smarter way to do it, I think.
Indeed. So that's a way of getting comfortable with being uncomfortable. Right, moving on, lesson number 4, learn languages.
Yeah, so not talking about French or Italian or Spanish, a slightly different tact here. I mean, a lot of the stuff I've talked about here might be related to, you know, how to succeed in business. When I talk about learn languages, I'm actually referring to the book, The 5 Love Languages by Gary Chapman. And this was probably a book I was exposed to in my sort of late teenage years and early 20s. And the author spent a lot of time counseling couples and realized that a common misunderstanding between couples was they spoke different languages and spoke different love languages. And so he came up with 5 love languages. And you're nodding your head here, Jeff, because I think it sounds like you've been exposed to this concept or this book as well.
Oh, yeah.
And so some of those love languages from memory are things like physical touch. So, you know, your partner likes to be touched. Words of affirmation, so, you know, words of encouragement and compliments. Help me out here, Jeff. What else?
There's gifts.
Gifts. Yeah. So giving gifts.
Yeah. Spending time together.
Quality time. That's correct. And we're missing one more.
Oh, you're really testing me now.
Acts of service.
That's it. Okay,
so
yes.
Doing things for the other person. And so often the way we show love to our partner is by showing what our personal love language is as opposed to what our partner's love language is. And so your relationship will be a lot smoother and happier if you understand your partner's love language. And so instead of thinking of yourself, think of the other person. And yeah, so, you know, relatively simple concepts once you understand it, but it makes a lot of difference.
So has this ever helped you in your life, in your relationships?
Yeah, so I've been happily married for... I should know how many years.
That's usually probably a sign of a good marriage. You don't even...
Yes, quite a while. And, you know, probably, you know, at some point I realised that my wife's love language was acts of service. And the way she wanted me to. So it was mine as gifts. And I used to buy her gifts on her wedding anniversary, her birthday, Christmas, any occasion. And I used to think, you know, oh, I'm a great husband. You know, what woman doesn't like gifts? Lots of gifts and thoughtful gifts. And I soon realized, you know, she'd be happy receiving them, but they didn't thrill her as much as I hoped they would. And it's because her love language is acts of service. So she would probably prefer if I did more things around the house or just different things. And so, yeah, I think that was an interesting lesson for me. And yeah, I'm glad I know it around the gym. You know, keep going through the rest of my life, spending lots of money on things that maybe weren't so important to her.
I should just pause for a minute there for our listeners. This may be the single greatest piece of wisdom ever shared on this podcast.
Yes, there you go.
If there's one thing that we could share with the world to make the world a little bit better, I think that might be it.
Yeah, well, let's have your marriage.
Lesson number 5. I love this one. And, you know, for more than reasons than one, but just do it, as Nike says.
Just do it is the Nike slogan. And as you would have guessed, the book I'm referring to is Shoe Dog by Phil Knight. A great book to read. I got it for my son to read, who at the time was probably 11 or 12. I think there's a junior version of it as well, but it's an easy read. And there's probably nothing in the book that's groundbreaking, but the message I got from it was just around giving things a go. And so often I talk to people that have great ideas and are just waiting for the right opportunity. And that opportunity comes and goes. And, you know, I think for me, just understanding that progress is better than perfection, that if you're waiting for the right opportunity, whatever it is, you're not going to get anything done. And so success in business or success in life, it's not a linear thing. There's bumps in the road, there's ups and downs. And if you read the book by Phil Knight, who is the founder of Nike, he experienced many setbacks, but he just kept going. And one of the largest companies in the world as a result. And so, yeah, again, it's a reminder that you're never going to have the perfect time, but at the end of the day, as Nike says, just do it.
And that just reminds me of that old adage, you missed 100% of the shots you don't take.
Yeah. Was that a Wayne Gretzky or a Michael Jordan? I both said something similar.
I'm sure there's basketball background to all that, but that's just burned in the back of my memory. Mm. So lesson number 6, be humble. Now, I know you live this one.
Yeah. So I think one of the most important books I've read about business is from an author called Jim Collins called Good to Great. Good to Great, it's a classic. And what Jim did over many years was look at something like 1,400 companies in the US and work out which were enduringly great companies. So not companies that were just great over a period of time, but over decades. And out of the 11 that he narrowed it down to, he looked at the qualities that made these companies so successful and the number of attributes within these companies. But the one that stood out to me was around leadership. And he spoke about the difference between different levels of leadership, but what he called level 4 leadership and then level 5 leadership. And each of these 11 great companies had level 5 leaders on them. And there was one particular feature in each of these leaders that stood out, and that was around humility. Leaders that weren't ego-driven, that didn't rely just on themselves, but had the foresight and I'd say the intelligence to question themselves and to recognize that they weren't always going to be the smartest people in the room. And, you know, Jim also spoke about the concept of, you know, when something goes well, look out the window. So don't look at yourself. But when something goes wrong, look in the mirror. And I think that's really stuck with me that, you know, there are times where things don't go well in the business and it's easy for me to blame others. But, you know, often I just try to look at myself and what role did I play and what did I learn from it and vice versa. You know, amongst the many successes we've had, you know, it's nice to say that it was all because of me, but in reality, I have a really great team that I work with and I wouldn't be able to achieve what I do without. So Yeah. I think that's really important as your listeners progress through their careers, that it's easy to be ego-driven and to think that, you know, all the success is because of you. But I think the good way to look at it is to be humble about it and, yeah, continue to question yourself, and that will make you a better leader.
Indeed. And I think if I recall correctly, Good to Great is about companies that are successful beyond the tenure of the leader themselves. So they're companies that went on to greater heights after the leader have left the organization. And that's because the leader themselves have engendered a culture of that humility and be able to inspire greater leaders to come after them to continue that legacy. So indeed, it's about leadership that's greater than yourself.
It is. And, you know, just briefly, a couple other concepts in that book around, you know, building great cultures is getting the right people on the bus, for example. And so getting the right people on the bus, that if we come down to values, we come down to things other than a technical experience, then, you know, once you get them on the bus and the right fit, then you work out what seats they're in. And so that's, yeah, I think that was also another lesson learned for me in terms of building our property business.
Thanks for that. Lesson number 7, join a gym. I'm a member of the gym, so I guess I've already done that. Yeah. What do you mean by joining a gym?
Well, it sounds like you've ticked the box there, Jeff. I mean, I'm a member of a gym as well, but it's not the kind of gym that I'm referring to. This is a book called Strength Finders by Tim Brass, and it's a book I use quite often if I'm coaching someone new. It's a book I give to the person, and if it's someone new in our company, it's part of our onboarding process. And the book Strength Finders, a great book. It talks about 34 strengths, and as you go through it, the exercise or as an online survey that you do from the book, it helps you identify what your top 5 strengths are. And the reason why it's important to understand what your strengths are is because it's important to ensure that you are utilizing these strengths in what you are doing each and every day. Well, yeah, for often we are, if you think about going to school and getting your report from school, a typical Asian parent, they'll skim over your good marks, they'll skim over the A's and look for where there's B's or C's, right? And that's where they expect you to spend a lot of your time from there on, you know? And Strength Finders looks at things a bit differently. It says, you know, don't spend all your time on your weaknesses, but invest in your strengths, because there's this multiplier effect. You can achieve a lot more by maximizing your strengths. And, you know, you can achieve mastery from your strengths, not from your weaknesses. And so I think a really good lesson for businesses for years is understand your employees' strengths and make sure that they are utilizing those strengths. And I think if they do, you know, the evidence shows that they're more motivated in their jobs, they're happier, there's less turnover of staff, and there are studies around, you know, companies with greater profit as a result of investing in their team members' strengths.
Yeah, indeed. And it speaks volumes in the fact that you invest that time to discover the strength of your new starters, because as a lot of people start in their companies, they're often being sent to training, you know, which are supposed to address, you know, their lack of knowledge or other shortfalls. But very seldom they get made to feel, you know, I suppose, valued and important by the CEO of a company sitting down with them and discovering exactly what they brought to the table. Now, I think in essence, what you're saying here is that you can then bring more of yourself, you know, more of what you bring to the table into your work. You can, you know, essentially give, I suppose, a more authentic self to the organization and be valued for it. And I think in some respects, of course, that makes perfect sense, because the more you can bring to of yourself to work, the more comfortable you're in that environment, the more likely you're going to be able to achieve the kind of results. Yep. It's almost a bit of a no-brainer. I'm surprised not many more companies do this as a routine.
Yeah, and I think it comes down to, you know, everyone is unique, and there is so much we can gain from people's uniqueness. Again, so often people spend their time and energy trying to fit in as opposed to showing who they are and what they're capable of. And so coming back to the onboarding process for us, you know, I do a few sessions with every new employee, and a lot of that's built around self-awareness and trying to help them understand themselves better. And so we do this values exercise with the cards, we do strength finders, we do a few different exercises just to help them unpack and uncover things about themselves they may not have had the opportunity to realize before. And that helps bring out their authentic selves as well. And, you know, I think I'm a believer in the strength of diversity in our team. And, you know, we're much stronger from diverse views and diverse personalities and things like that, as opposed to everyone being the same.
Indeed. And how much more would you appreciate it, would you feel appreciated if your employer helped you discover strength that you're not even aware that you have, right? So that's clearly a very worthwhile exercise. Mm. Lesson number 8, choose your response. And I like that word, choose, because it firmly puts yourself in charge.
It does. And at the end of the day, there are many things we can't control. But one thing that is within our control is our response. This came from a book, a very well-known book written just after the Second World War by Viktor Frankl, and it's called Man's Search for Meaning. And Viktor Frankl basically spent a number of years in a Nazi concentration camp. And in all the despair and suffering and difficult times in that concentration camp, he writes that, you know, they could take everything away from him, but one thing they couldn't take away was how he responded. And within that ability to choose, that gave him freedom. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think whether we're driving on the street and someone sort of suddenly pulls in front of you and you want to give them the finger or whatever. You know, if I put it in context to Viktor Frankl's experience in the concentration camp, that nothing could be worse than the situation he was in, but he found a way to decide to choose how he responded in those most difficult times. And so, you know, we have the ability of choice. And so we can respond to difficult times, to things that happen to us in a negative way or in a positive way. At the end of the day, it's choice. Yep. So you can choose your response.
But the lesson isn't necessarily the choice or freedom per se, but it's the awareness that you still got that choice, the awareness that you still got that agency despite the circumstances. So really, this whole thing is about not being a victim of circumstance, but rather to acknowledge that no matter how bad things get, that you still have a choice, that you still are in control ultimately of your own destiny.
True. Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it, understanding that, that's something that's available to us.
But I feel like people choose to be victims more often than not, than choosing to acknowledge their agency. You know, how does this relate to what we're seeing kind of today in as a general phenomenon of, you know, this celebration of victimhood?
Yeah, and it's an interesting, I guess, trend we're seeing in society. And, you know, again, earlier at lunch, we were talking about our own kids and their upbringings, how they're given a lot more opportunities than we had when we were growing up. And what does that do to them? How does it impact their resilience even? And resilience is a big thing. You know, as we went through COVID, how well prepared were we for things like that? And again, you know, if I talk about COVID, you know, it was a difficult time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a result, there's, you know, a lot of mental health discussions have come up from it, which I think is a great thing. But it's a reminder that, you know, through our lives, we're going to be faced with similar things to that difficult times, and how well prepared are we to face those? So I think it's a reminder to all of us that
we have that choice.
We have that choice, but, you know, if we don't practice that choice, it's going to be difficult.
Yeah, indeed. And I think we discussed that as we raise our children, we need to raise them with adversity, but also at the same time teach them how to acknowledge that they've always got that choice in the face of adversity. So definitely choose your response is a key lesson that we need to pass down.
Yeah, and we have to let them fail and all that kind of
and get up. Exactly. Yeah. So lesson number 9, success is intentional.
Success is intentional. You could probably relate it to having a choice as well. But there's a great book called Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell. And the book's probably famous because what it writes about is a 10,000-hour rule. So Gladwell looked at outliers in society, the ones that have achieved amazing things. So not your sort of normal average people. And what he found was a combination of things, but success was also a result of hard work. And that 10,000 hour rule is probably something I hear quite a lot, even in sport, where, you know, if you want to be reach the upper echelons of your sport, then you need to put in the hard work. And that's a lot of hours, 10,000 hours. So, you know, again, often people can say, you know, I wasn't born physically fast enough or strong enough, or I didn't have, my parents weren't Olympians and therefore I'm at a disadvantage. But success is intentional. And, you know, Malcolm Gladwell does identify there are other things such as luck involved in achieving success. There's other things like even your race. And he sort of does this, there's a part about why Asians are so good at maths. And sort of growing up, I guess, with the, you know, growing rice and crops and having the work ethic needed. And yeah, you see it these days, it is evident amongst the Asian kids. Yeah, so again, a good book to read. Even talks about timing. So I think they studied some elite hockey teams in ice hockey teams in Canada and found that 80% of the teams were people born in the first 3 months of the year. And I think what they recognized from that was, I guess, because of physical advantages and developments, they were the ones picked for the representative teams. And so they were just given that those opportunities and advantages over years, and the cumulative effects of that has enabled them to, I guess, have a higher chance of success than others.
Because they have a higher confidence than their peers born in later months. But I think the same was also true for people born in regional small towns because they're used to being the top dog.
Yep.
And in that confidence carry them through even when they move into the big leagues in the big city. So that's a very profound insight, I think. Now, before I get into lesson number 10, I'm going to throw you a little curveball as we do at 10 lessons. Yep. So what have you unlearned? And what I mean by that is something that you've held to be ironclad truth when you started your career 20 years ago, and now that you've learned that it's just not true otherwise. So what would you have told your younger self that, you know, you probably should change your mind about?
Oh, well, probably lots of things. I mean, I would say that the nine lessons that I've spoken about are probably things that's earlier in my career that maybe I didn't recognize. If I had to choose one, I actually did a talk at a graduation at UTS a few years ago, and it was about self-limiting beliefs. And I think that's something that applies to a lot of us. We think things, or we're told things that hold us back from being, well, from being able to live to our potential. And I would say, for me, one of the best things that I've learnt or unlearned is around the mindset. And, you know, I think we all have elements of having a fixed mindset in certain areas. And I think probably the light switched for me when I was at university, and I think I was around 20, and something happened to me when I look back, it probably sounds a bit silly, but I used to play a lot of touch football and representative touch football, and I made the team for UTS, my university, to play at the Australian University Games. So every year, all the universities around Australia come together and compete in different sports. And I had this goal to make the Australian University team. And after all the matches, you know, I'd worked my butt off in preparation for it. And when I didn't make the team, it was probably the first time in my life where I'd really tried hard to achieve something and I didn't achieve it. And so I could have, I dropped my head, and whilst it was disappointing, and there were tears at the time, I have to admit, I could have dropped my head and just given up, or I could have gone the opposite way. And I think from that time, I made a decision to myself that I would set myself goals and I would try to be the best that I could be. And, you know, since that time, I guess I did a lot of things I wouldn't have done if I didn't experience that. And that's from just setting a lot of goals in a lot of things that I did, to, you know, traveling around the world backpacking on my own, to even things like bungee jumping and skydiving that maybe I probably would have passed at, to, you know, recognizing that okay, I wasn't a natural speaker, and so I ended up doing Toastmasters and I did a year of drama classes and things in my 20s, which again, a lot of people wouldn't do. And so I think recognizing that, sorry, moving from that fixed mindset to a more of a growth mindset and recognizing that I could improve myself, whatever it was, has really helped me in my life.
So in essence, the failure was a liberating experience for you to realize that you could be a lot more, and you're not defined by, you know, something that was already pre-existing, but by, you know, what you can control. So that's a great lesson to unlearn. So, all right, lesson number 10, become literate in money.
Yeah, so, yeah, this one I would say, this is a book I would also want to give to my kids because, and I see even amongst my staff, you know, they're married, they have kids, but one thing that they've probably missed out on was understanding money, you know, how to manage money and what to do with it. And it's such, so, I mean, all people think about is, you know, I'm going to save some money and then I'm going to get a mortgage to buy a house and those kinds of things. But I think it's important at a young age to really understand the importance of money and investing. And I think the sooner you recognize that, the better off you're going to be. And I think, you know, growing wealth, it's a bit like a tree. It starts off with a seed and it just grows over time. You need to keep watering that tree. But the sooner you do it, the earlier you do it, then the bigger that tree is going to be. And I think it's just a fundamental thing I find a lot of younger people miss out on. And so this is a book called The Richest Man in Babylon by George S. Casson. And it's a short read and it's an easy read because it's sort of written in sort of these parables, but it just teaches you some fundamentals around money. And yeah, again, something that everyone, all of us need. And, you know, I look at myself after university, my first full-time job, I did two things. One was, I guess, sponsor a child, and I've been doing that since then. But the other thing was start investing in the stock market. And I've learned a lot through that process, but I think also, you know, it's helped generate funds for me or wealth for me that I wouldn't have if I didn't even consider it. So, yeah.
Indeed. So it's not necessarily about making or accumulating great wealth, but it's having that financial freedom so you can, I suppose, spend time on the things which are important to your values.
Yeah, and it gives you, I guess, freedom and flexibility to then, spend time in other areas that you feel are more important to you.
And that's great wisdom indeed. Thank you so much for that, Brad. And we'll finish on that note. You've been listening to 10 Lessons Learned, the podcast that makes the world a little wiser lesson by lesson. We're joined today by our special guest, Brad Chan. This episode is produced by Robert Hossery and sponsored by the Professional Development Forum. Don't forget to leave us a review or comment. You can even email us at podcast@10lessonslearned.com. That's podcast@10lessonslearned.com. Go ahead and hit that subscribe button so that you don't miss an episode of the only podcast that make the world a little wiser, lesson by lesson. Thanks for tuning in. Stay safe, everyone.